Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Mullen, joined by John Roerink, Simon Schuster, Jake Kanzler, and Jack Spencer. A little later, Senator Curtis Sertel from East Lansing will be joining us. He can tell us a little bit about his bracket. Maybe he can brag, John, because I can tell you mine's blown up right now. And I'd ask you about yours, but you didn't fill one out.
I was out for the week. I completely forgot about it, and all of a sudden the game started. I thought, oh, well, I don't have to worry about spending the pizza money.
Are you beating me in the bracket pool right now, Jacob?
I saw I was in first, but I think that was before the Duke loss, so I don't know where I'm at right now.
I'm going to have a hard time believing anyone who picks South Carolina, so you could be okay, just so you know. I wouldn't be too bent about the Duke loss.
Yeah, it usually comes down to like having at least one team make it to like the Final Four somewhere, so we'll see.
Mine is a sea of red right now. I think I'm in the bottom half of all three brackets I picked, and I picked three completely different brackets, thinking that one of them I was going to strike gold on. Instead, I laid three lemons.
And we should note, though, that the office pool has nothing of value pending upon the results of the games, because that would be wrong.
I do want to note, though, that the burden of shame has been passed on from Michigan State because Middle Tennessee State University claimed victory over Minnesota, and so our curse is lifted.
Well, let's move from college education to the K-12 education arena. How do you like that for a transition, Jacob? Because it seems like nobody is on the same page as it comes to whether we want to use an A-F system, if we want to shut schools down or we don't want to shut schools down, or even who's in charge and whether that person should be in charge in the first place. Why can't we all be on the same page when it comes to education policy?
Oh man, that's a big question to ask me, Kyle. I mean, a lot of this is happening right now. One of the reasons we're talking about this is probably the release of the 21st Century Education Report that the governor appointed and had a board put out. And they talk about kind of at the top and throughout the system kind of different kind of levels of governance. You got a state board of education that is elected by the people. They appoint the state superintendent. So the state superintendent responds to them, but is also part of the governor's cabinet. And so the board also runs the Department of Education, which is also part of the governor's cabinet, but the board runs it. And so, and then of course you have the legislature, which controls policy to a certain extent, statute, and also the budget. And then you have the governor in there as well. And so you have this shifting governance and the different roles at the top. And I think where some believe that plays a role in kind of why our education policy is fragmented.
And so as a result, we have different folks thinking we should grade schools on an A-F system. Some don't believe we should. And then at the same time, what should we do about failing schools? Should we shut them down or should we do some intensive mechanism? And all the while, the governor, while giving some control to the state superintendent, has taken control away and now has released a report saying, oh, you know what, I should have control over everything altogether, including who should be the superintendent. These moving of the deck chairs on the ship of the Titanic, Jack, how come we keep doing this on the administrative level while the quality of education in the state doesn't seem to be going anywhere?
Well, this goes back for decades. There were problems with education that everyone recognized several decades ago. And they decided, okay, what we've got to do is we've got to jump in here and make some fixes here, make some fixes there. The problem was the people jumping in to make the fixes weren't any more qualified to fix the situation than those that had been there in the first place. And ever since then, from my perspective, and I think even more so than I would have said 17 years ago, 17 years ago, the state jumping in with the Archer and the Engler stuff, for example, there was some logic to it. You could make some arguments for it. I think at this point you start looking at all of that stuff and you start going, wait a minute, is there really any evidence that what has been coming from the state down to the locals has done anything to improve anything in those 17 years, or has it just been a constant switching of the rules? About every 3 to 5 years, they rewrite the rules again and again, and they are arguing about basic things like, do you give an A-F grading system or something a little more nuanced where the interpretations may be more left up to the beholder? I really would be interesting to find out how many people really have confidence that whatever change they make this time isn't going to be reviewed and be up for change again 3 to 5 years from now.
And if we don't do A-F, John, it's the change about the test, what test we should use, this constant churn. What do you attribute it to?
It's the nature of the issue in a lot of ways. If you really want to understand the education system, think about the course or the life of a student. It's a 12-year process. And we have new groups of leaders coming in every 6 years in the House. You've got a new State Board of Education elected intermittently. Everybody has a cure for the problem. There is no single silver bullet cure for the problem of education. It takes a lot of long-term planning. It takes sticking with a test, seeing changes under one test instrument, and making long-term adjustments. But I don't know that we're capable any longer of a long-term management in a term-limited era.
If I was a teacher, I'd be completely frustrated.
I'd be furious. I would probably have left the career path of teacher.
It's like the goalposts. They don't just keep changing. They're like moving across the field at the same time. They're going forward. They're going backwards. They're going from side to side.
I mean, I think John really hit on a lot of the challenges, that this is really a field where there's a policy that have a lot of technical nuances to them, and finding, you know, what fits best for each state, and Michigan in particular, is not easy, because there's a wide range of people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, funding levels, and infrastructures in which people are being educated. And when you have the governance and oversight, which is fundamentally constrained, the institutional memory is, you know, on a 6 or even 14 year, like, if that's the full extent of how long our institutional memory can be, then you can't really do that sort of intergenerational planning and really view what's succeeding and what's failing with sober eyes.
Is there anything that the state can do to help improve the quality of education in the schools, other than just getting out of the way?
I think they should get out of the way. I think they should think about ways to depoliticize it. I know the governor wants more control in terms of put it in his office. I don't know what the answer is, but I think you got to take out some of the herks and jerks that come with the term limits and come with the constantly churning and changing leadership of our state.
Jacob?
I think it does take coordinated governance from one level. I mean, I think, you know, I think that's what the governor's commission was getting at, is that even though politically it looks tough because you're basically asking to remove an elected state board of education, run it through the governor, would that create more consistent governance? I don't know. You'd still have a term limited legislature that comes in and wants to do different things every 6 years, at least in the House, or every 2 years in the House, and then there's also issues at the local level. I mean, there's arguments out there that to save money, to spread out our resources, we need to consolidate our more than 500 school districts, and there's not a lot of political willpower at the local level to do that. So there's challenges, and there's institutions all throughout the system, federal, state, and local, and so it would take leadership to kind of break through some of those barriers.
And we should talk a little bit about the elected nature of the state school board of education. I mean, most voters, in honesty, don't really look at the qualifications of those people who are up for that ballot. As we know around this table, those races are used primarily as a gauge of the base partisan makeup of any given geography more than anything else. So I'm not sure that, you know, having an elected board is really going to bring us anything other than just a good measure of how many Democrats and how many Republicans live in a certain geography.
We're going to leave that topic for right now, because I wanted to get to, Jack, the question of why Arlen Meekhoff doesn't want to take up the Freedom of Information Act bill. He's made it clear it's not going to be taken up. So the bill is done dead now in the Senate. Why?
Well, I'm convinced he's just strongly opposed to it, and apparently from what we're hearing and all signs, he's got a majority of his own caucus that would rather not even deal with it at all. And it's really kind of biting off a problem he doesn't have to bite off, because he could have very easily said, okay, we're going to take a look at this, buried it in conversation forever in a committee. I don't necessarily think he had to confront this in a "we do not want to do this at all" stance. I don't understand why there would be a political reason for jumping ahead of everybody and saying we're just not going to do this at all. So I have to believe that it's just his honest opinion when he says there's no reason to do this. And by this, I mean FOIA reform overall, because he could be saying we need to do FOIA reform. It's just I don't agree with these bills. But no, he seems to just be saying there's just no real need here. And so I have to believe that this is what he honestly believes.
Is he just digging in his heels, John, being a stubborn Dutchman? He set his mind to saying that we're not going to do this, and now he keeps getting asked, and he's just getting stronger and stronger and saying, no.
I can personally attest there's nothing wrong with being a stubborn Dutchman.
That's why I asked you the stubborn Dutchman question.
No, I think, you know, having watched him field this question in a number of public forums and then on the floor in the scrums, I think he has a genuine belief that it is as some institutional threat doesn't really want to deal with, that it doesn't have to happen. The way those offices operate doesn't need to be exposed to that kind of light. You know, and a lot of folks, my friends at the Press Association are going to wince now, a lot of folks view FOIA much like they view campaign finance reform. They set out with the goal that everything needs to be exposed to the public, but what they don't realize is they're only changing the method of discourse. These conversations aren't going to take place in email anymore. They're not going to take place by a text message anymore. They're going to take place face-to-face. That same thing has happened in the agencies following what happened with Flint. I'm sure there's a lot of coordination about we're going to tamp down on email. We're going to have more face-to-face conversations over the phone conversations because we don't want thought process, strategy process to be exposed to FOIA. It's much like campaign finance. You start to regulate it, the money flows in a different way.
Kind of like trying to block water, yeah, right? Yeah, and the water will find a way to get where it's...
Gravity will find a way of bringing down the leaves in the fall. You're not going to regulate it, an end to it.
Now, I'm going to just throw this out from a political standpoint. Now, I'm not going to debate what you guys said, but from a political standpoint for Republicans, there is no reason to do it, maybe necessarily right now, from the sense that the governor doesn't want this, right? Because from the governor's standpoint, this opens up the governor to FOIA, while it doesn't open up the legislature to full FOIA, right? For the legislature, they're going to have to release their public calendars and some letters from lobbyists, and that's about it, right? That's the only thing that's going to really apply to them. For the governor, it's the full enchilada, which I'm sure the governor doesn't want to see on his desk. So in that regard, Mikoff's taking the bullet for the governor. On the other hand, though, too, if you think about this, this is a great issue that the legislature could pursue in the 2019-20 session, presuming that a Democrat is our next governor. If you have a Republican House and a Republican Senate, and this is all hypothetical, right? You have a Republican House and a Senate. What better thing to send to a Democratic governor than opening up that Democratic governor to FOIA and then putting that person in a position of saying yes or no? I think that would make, from a political standpoint, a pretty crass move.
I agree with you, Kyle. I think that it would be crass. And I think that people who would be opposed to that move would just have to say, look at 2 years ago when there was a different person in that office and look at how the legislature viewed it then.
We'll see how they end up handling it. I'm sure that this will probably be the last time we talk about FOIA for some time, unless there's some critical mass or some reason to move it until then. I think that's going to be the end of that. Join us now in MERS World Headquarters, Senator Curtis Sertel. Thanks for joining us, Senator.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, I'm not going to rub in that I picked UCLA to go all the way, so I'm doing better on my bracket than you are. But you probably are going to beat me just because my brackets totally stink.
I had a Duke in the final game, which was hard to pick because I'm not a huge Duke fan. So I'm rooted against myself last night a little bit. I mean, the upsets are what's fun about the tournament. I mean, it's always good to root for the underdog.
Right. No, I completely agree. Even Middle Tennessee State this year, not last year.
No. I enjoyed rooting for them this year a lot more than last year's game. That's for damn sure.
Well, we were just talking on the podcast here about the FOIA bills and the fact that Senator Mikoff has decided that he doesn't want to take them up. Let me get your impression. Why do you think he doesn't want to take these up?
I don't know the answer of why he doesn't want to. I think that it's wrong. I mean, I think that Michigan has one of the least accessible information from legislators and the executive branch. And it's even frustrating for legislators sometimes. We had a situation last week in the Capital Outlay Committee where the DTMB wouldn't share the recommendations that other departments had made to the governor's office with the chairman who was asking for it. So the ones that weren't actually funded, the ones that were just requested from other departments, we couldn't get that information. Now, we're supposed to be the deciding body on the budget. The governor proposes the budget, but we're the ones that are supposed to do it. And even Darwin Boer, who's the chairman of that committee, was being denied information. And I pointed out that it was kind of ironic that was happening during Sunshine Week. We shouldn't have secrets in this business. I mean, we're working with the taxpayers' money. They're our bosses. And
if this bill gets up on the board, do you think it passes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Overwhelmingly. I would be shocked if there were actually very many members that would vote against it. I mean, who wants to be publicly opposed to the public having more information about what we do?
So is this one of those situations where maybe behind the scenes, Mikoff is hearing from his people, I don't really want this, But if it were actually a public vote, they would have no choice but really to support it?
I think that that's probably part of it. And, you know, we can all negotiate on details. Actually, I think that these are pretty light bills if you really want to get into it in terms of legislative oversight. A lot of the things that we do would be exempt from it. I actually would be in support of a full FOIA bill. I think that everything we do should be accessible to the public.
Even the constituent stuff.
Yeah, I mean, if a constituent files a claim with the Department of Environmental Quality, they have the ability to do it. Obviously, individual constituent cases we're working on, you can make a case. We're helping somebody. We have a HIPAA form. Those things are, I think, could be exempt. But somebody writes me a letter and I respond to them. Why wouldn't that be accessible to other people? And I think the governor's office has that same issue. But if you look at any department, or when I was on the county commission, for example, I couldn't just say this was unfoyable and other things were. And I had those same problems there. I had the same constituent conversations. I had the same inner conversations between commissioners that were accessible. Why was my ability to keep things secret less important then than it is for the legislature now? I think if we're asking everybody else in government to live up to a certain standard, then we all should live up to it.
Now, what about posting state employee salaries online? That's become an issue now.
I don't have a problem with the concept. That what I have a problem with more than anything else in that regard is the lack of protection for individual people. There are reasons why you wouldn't want your individual information made public, and I think there are not enough protections. And I think that actually my brother, Representative Hertel, had a good amendment that would have allowed for a process for a person to actually request that and to go through some process for that. It was unfortunately rejected by the committee. At this point, you have the head of the department making all those decisions, and they might not have the understanding of an individual situation, like somebody who has a personal protection order out against somebody.
So what do you do in those cases? So John Smith, DEQ minion, should his salary of $50,000 a year be publicly available on a website?
I would say that the information is already FOIA-able. It's already accessible to people. They have the ability to do it. I think putting on the website causes other problems. Okay. that I would like at least a process for that person to get out of that if they have a reasonable safety concern that is not included in the current bill.
Have you had constituents come to you and say, Senator, I'm concerned that my information is going to expose me more to fraud, to trolling, to however you
Absolutely.
Want to determine.
I had a coffee hour last week in Mason, and we had some state employees that had that concern. And I think it's a real concern. The nice thing about FOIA is you know who asked for it. Mm-hmm. So you have that ability to actually at least know what situation you're getting yourself into and who requested the information. And if there's a reason for them not to have the information, you can make an argument.
Now you don't have to ask. Here's a list of employees. Here's a list of salary numbers.
You know, unfortunately, there is a high rate of domestic violence in this country. And state employees are certainly not immune from that. So if you have somebody who has a personal protection order about somebody or has some other legitimate reason to be concerned, I don't know why you wouldn't want to put a process in for them. An amendment that was put in to actually do that was rejected. So for me, that's a big concern. It's really hard to get people to want to be state employees right now. Mm-hmm. The morale is very low. If you go and talk to state employees, if we want the best people to do these jobs, you have to have some reasonable protections for them. And I just think there's been a really lack of respect in general for state employees, and to make it harder to get qualified people to do these jobs.
Would you be a no vote if it came to
under the current form? Absolutely, I'd be a no vote.
You're a little surprised that Arlen Meekhoff, the Senate leader, would be so strongly against doing anything with this. Even if you don't like this, the political thing many would have done in the past is say, we're going to take a look at it, throw it in committee, and let it just go on and on forever instead of this just in your face, we're not going to do it.
Yeah, well, I would say that I would guess, and I haven't talked to Arlen about this specifically, I would guess there's a certain amount of freedom in not running for office again. The decision that was made to not run for governor, I think that probably he's more free to say whatever he wants. Not that Arlen's really ever had a problem saying whatever he wants, so I think that's probably, he is one of the more, I think, open people about his position on things, which I appreciate, actually. So as much as I disagree with his decision, I think it's a much more respectful position to tell us all what it is. So I can't really argue with that at all.
Does this simply go away in a year or two when we're 3 or 4 years away from Flint?
No, I think there'll always be push for sunshine. I think that Flint certainly has highlighted it with some of the things that came out during it and some of the things that I think were not accessible. But I mean, just like what happened in my committee this past week, that kind of information should be available not just to me as a legislator, but to the public. What executive privilege is it to not provide information to the taxpayers about what other departments requested a capital outlay project? I mean, what are we trying to protect there, other than only being able to support the ones the governor wants to do? That is, to me, fundamentally wrong, in the sense that, one, every legislator should have that information available to them, because we're the ones that are actually supposed to do a budget, and we can listen to what the executive wants, but we should have as much information as he has in the ability to make the budget. That's, I think, too often we in the legislature have given up authority to the executive branch, and we need to stop that. We need to act like our roles matter. But the public should have that information too. If there's an unsafe building out there, if there's something that the public should know about, that something's run down, or that some other project would provide more jobs or have be more important to the public, they should have the ability to know that kind of information. That's what governments should be about.
Okay, I'm just curious, because in my time, it seems like Flint has brought this issue to its high water mark. Which is why I wonder, in 2 years, is Laura just going to disappear and fade back into the woodwork?
Flint certainly gave us another argument on it, and surely was a great example, in my opinion, of a dramatic failure of government that calls into question what we do. But I think in general, I think this last election taught us anything, that there is a fundamental feeling on both sides that legislators and government in general is not working for the people. And I don't think that's going to go away anytime soon. And I think that if we can learn one lesson from this last election, is that's what people are interested in. They want to know the government is working for them, and they don't feel like it is right now.
How bummed are you that Congressman Mike Bishop has turned down your invitation to have some joint town halls?
Well, you know, I never expected him to say, yeah, we're going to have a town hall with you. I mean, I think it would be nice if he did, and I don't think it would be a bad thing. And in fact, I think, you know, having watched David Trott's town hall, and I watched it over the weekend, you know, I think that it might be a more respectful conversation if I'm there. But what I would say on the other side of that is, the most important thing is that he has a town hall. Every single coffee hour that I go to, the number one conversation that I have in my district over and over and over again is, where's Mike Bishop? People feel like they've been disenfranchised and they won't be listened to. And I think that the number one thing that we can do as legislators is listen. We don't have all the answers. We need to know what other people are going through. And I meet with people who vehemently disagree with me on a regular basis. And they come to my coffee hours, and sometimes, is it uncomfortable? Sure. I mean, do I have anti-vaccine people that show up at my coffee hours and argue about different points of an issue that we disagree with greatly? Yeah, that happens. But we talk and we listen to each other, and they at least feel like they were heard at the end of the day, even though I might not change my opinion. You know, I represent 240,000 people. If any of them call and ask for a meeting, they get it. I know it's a little harder when you're in Congress. I respect the congressman's time. But at the end of the day, if you live in this part of the district, we used to have, you know, under Mike Rogers, although we vehemently disagreed on things, I never could ever say that he didn't listen. You know, if I wanted to talk to him about an issue, we were able to get on the calendar. If they had a town hall meeting, they did it on a fairly regular basis. They did one up here. They had a district office here. They had a district coordinator here. We don't see that. Mike has not made a good effort to create a relationship with this part of the district. And I get it, we're a little more Democratic than the rest of the district, but we still matter. We're still voters in his district, and he should listen to us. Not do what we say, but listen to us. And I think that's what's lacking. And I think I really do feel strongly that he should have a town hall in this area. And I'm going to keep pushing, and I'm going to keep making it an issue until he does.
Is there anything to the other side argument coming back and saying the reason that he might not want to do this is because the only thing that really comes out of it is a story if there's a big protest or a big incident? Nothing comes out of it in terms of actual discussion with constituents.
It just turns out to be an ambush.
See, I don't think that's what I've seen. I mean, I think Justin Amash has been having pretty amazing town halls over on the west side of the state, and we should never be afraid to make our argument that if we believe in it. That's our job as elected officials. So, no, I don't believe that.
Just going to get ambushed and beat up, why go through it all?
Well, first of all, I'm sorry, but I didn't get in this business to run away from the public. So I don't feel that great concern. I go places all the time with people who disagree with me. I don't have a problem doing that. I'm very pretty thick skin. I think that's what it takes sometimes to be in elective office. No, I mean, no, I don't feel bad for Mike Bishop for avoiding the public. No, I don't. I mean, yeah, yes. Do I think that there'll be some angry people? Sure. If I was sitting in a town hall, if I was sitting in David Trott's town hall this week, and David and I've sued David Trott. When I was Registrar of Deeds, we sued him for illegal foreclosures and we tried to keep people in their homes. David and I don't exactly get along all the time. If I had been in that town hall, there were times where I would have said, if everyone could just listen for a minute and let the congressman make his point, I would appreciate it. And I would do the same thing for Mike Bishop. I think that it's important that if we want people to listen to us, that we listen back as well and that we actually listen to the answers. But at the same time, those people aren't even given that opportunity right now. So I mean, and a teletown hall is not a town hall. I mean, you control who speaks, you control who can respond. You don't get to actually listen to what the public is doing. I think the teletown halls are fine. You can do them. But they don't replace the actual meeting with your constituents. And to the point where, you know, now we have Capitol Police saying you can't walk into congressmen's offices and those, you know, people are posting signs. They're basically closed for business to people walking in. What is our job? Our job is to actually represent a group of people in Congress or in the legislature. That's our job. You cannot do that without listening to them. We cannot always live in our own ideological bubble. I think that's part of the problem with America right now, that we do that.
Senator Curtis Sertel, thanks for coming to MERS World Headquarters. Happy to give you the Democratic mug there, too. So you
thank you, my friend. I appreciate that. Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to the crew here, John, Simon, Jacob, and Jack, and Senator Curtis Sertel for joining us at MERS World Headquarters. Jack, I know you really wanted to fill out that bracket really bad, and you just completely slipped your mind. But if you would have filled one out, would you have had Michigan in the Sweet 16? Be honest.
No, I would have had them win the first game against Oklahoma, but I would have had them losing to Louisville.
How about Villanova? Would you have them winning?
No, I would have definitely stuck with Villanova. I probably would have had them making it all the way to the Final Four.
All right, at least you're being honest on this whole thing. You wouldn't have won you might not have won the bracket.
I'm always honest unless there's something really at stake.
he wouldn't have won that prize that has no monetary or other significant value.
Yeah, I'll try to drown my sorrow at not winning the prize that has no monetary value.
Now, who would your national champion have been, you think?
Probably North Carolina.
Okay.
When in doubt, say North Carolina.
Simon, would your national champion been Middle Tennessee State?
No, it would not.
Okay, who would it have been?
Are we talking about racquetball or squash, Kyle?
Oh, God. All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm Kyle Mullen. Until next week, take care.